The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, in this practical philosophy, Kant thought that he had uncovered the deeper meaning of relating all of experience to this I think. As we saw, if you think, then you think this and that and the other. But accompanying all of this thinking is this I think. It is I think this, I think that, and that is the formal logical unity, Kant said, in our thinking. Now, in this practical philosophy, Kant thought he had uncovered the deeper meaning of his relating all of experience to this I think, to the transcendental unity of apperception, as he called it. It was by means, then, of the practical philosophy that he desired to uncover the true source of human freedom and worth. Kant is going to develop an ethical philosophy, and by reflecting on man as an ethical being, he is going then to uncover the true source of human freedom and worth. Now, within the realm open to the understanding, what he called the phenomenal realm, we distinguish between the phenomenal realm, which then is the realm of our experience, the realm of the phenomena of our experience. He said, this is open to our understanding. This over against the noumenal realm. A noumenal realm is that which is open not to experience, but simply to our thought. But within the realm, open to the understanding, namely the phenomenal realm, Kant said, one does not discover either true freedom nor the infinite worth of personality. Now, in order to understand this, it is well to look for a few moments at the pattern which is appropriate to our experience of the phenomena, our experience within the phenomenal world. One can say here that certain arbitrary goals are set up, and these then are set in terms of certain subjective desires. And then the means are calculated in a technical way for the realization of these external goals. I can diagram it in this way. If we think in terms of the standard humanistic view of subject and object, if you have an S for the subject, then you can put an S down and draw a line, and then after that put an O for subject and object. And then starting just at the top of the S, just about over a little to the right, one draws a kind of circle around the O and back to the S again, an oblong shape around the O and back underneath to the S. That is a picture, that is a diagram which, to my mind, represents this picture of finite experience as Kant gives it. Within this pattern, then, an object is related to a subject for a certain purpose. I possibly have already given the illustration that I give for this. Namely, why do I teach at Westminster Theological Seminary? In order to earn some money so that I can buy shoes for my children. Why do I buy shoes for my children so that they can go to school? and so that they can learn, and so that they later on might possibly teach, and so that they could earn some money to buy some shoes for their children so they can go to school, and on and on and on. Within this pattern, a pattern which Kant said is characteristic of our finite experience, there is no stopping place. The activity of the subject is related to an external goal, which in turn is dependent for its meaning upon yet another external goal, and this process continues on indefinitely. Now, this, I say, is a pattern, is the pattern of what Kant called our finite experience. It is the pattern of that which we have within the realm of our understanding, within the realm of the phenomenal. And Kant said one discovers here neither true freedom nor the infinite worth of personality. Now, we can see that a little bit better when we consider that Kant considers a goal external, that is, if I as a subject have in mind a certain object or goal, and then for a certain purpose, this goal or this object stand outside of me, he said. To be involved with finite goals is to be determined from the outside. The activity of the self here is determined heteronymously. That law for its action then comes from somewhere else, from something else or other. It is, the self is determined heteronymously. It responds to the demands which are established by an external object. Well, and let's remember again what we've said before. We have to be very, very careful about what internal, external means here. Because as we said, according to this way of thinking, that which is internal is that which is identical with the self in its act. Identical with the self in its act. And anything that falls outside of this then is external. Well, if we are looking at a goal outside of ourselves that's not simply identical with our act, that then impinges on us from the outside. It sets a goal for us, it sets an object for us that is heteronymous. It comes from somewhere else. It is comes from a place other than our own personality. Now, the activity of the self then is determined heteronymously. It responds to the demands which are established by an external object. And in calculating the means for realizing the goals, there is no intrinsic reason for not including every possible means, for not including, let us say, other people. Within this scheme, Kant said, other persons, other personalities can just as well be understood as finite ends as anything we might consider. So within this pattern, there's a tendency then to reduce everything to a means for our ends. Now, for Kant, what is found then within the realm of the phenomenal, within the realm of finite concerns, does not correspond with what is the seat of the self. Now, I'm using a word here, the seat of the self, that in which the selfhood resides, that which is the seat of the self. It does not correspond with what is the source of freedom and worth. And so if one remains within the sphere of finite concerns, Immanuel Kant said, there is no way of securing a place for the infinite worth of personality. You say, that personality is infinite in its worth. That is, its worth cannot be then calculated, let's say, in terms of the value to society of someone, or this or that or the other. But it has to have a worth that resides in itself. And Kant said, as long as we are thinking within this pattern of finite concerns, there's no way of securing a place for the infinite worth of personality. There is no way of stopping personality from being reduced to the level of an object for use. And so Kant, as I've suggested already, looked in another direction. He attempted to find the seat, S-E-A-T, the seat, you could use the Latin word locus, L-O-C-U-S, to find the seat of human personality in the moral self. Now, how then do you understand the moral self, or how did Kant understand the moral self? He thought of the self as constituting itself a self by obedience to what he called the categorical imperative, the ultimate, quote unquote, thou shalt. Now, within the finite pattern, what you have is the pattern of hypothetical judgment. If I want to do this, then I do that. If I want Y, then I have to do X. You have if, then, a hypothetical judgment. But if you're going to understand the seat of personality, you have to move beyond that. You have to think in terms of a categorical imperative, a simple thou shalt. Something which then is not dependent upon any external finite considerations. We might just give an example of this from a biblical belief. Does one then want to go to heaven? Then we say, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, or thou shalt be saved, to quote the King James. Well, there's an if-then. And if you want to go to heaven, then you believe in Jesus Christ. Is Christ then reduced to one who is simple, an instrument to get us to heaven? Is our religion then reduced to a simple desire to save our skins? If you look at it within this system of finite concerns, it might well be. And in fact, it is criticized that way, that what you're doing is reducing religion to matters of finite concern, saving your skin and going to heaven, being saved in this way. And people again and again have said in the liberal circles, no, that is unworthy. That is unworthy of man as a moral being. That is unworthy of moral or ethical religion. Well, the ultimate thou shalt, Kant said, is not dependent upon any external finite considerations. And so if you're going to have the type of attitude toward man which is being signaled here, you have to get away from that kind of thinking. You have to move in this direction. One is to act, Kant said, so that the maxim or the subjective rule of his action can be made a universal rule. One must act, or one is to act, Kant said, so that the maxim or the subjective rule of his action can be made a universal rule. And this, then, is the law of the practical reason. Now, I also give an illustration from time to time from something that happened to me in third grade. I'm sure that some of you have heard this before, but I hope you'll bear with me because it does illustrate this. that when I was in third grade, the teacher made me sit right in front of her because I'm afraid I was somewhat too talkative. And one time I made a wise crack. I apparently hadn't learned my lesson. And she said, "Bob," there were seven of us in the class, and she pointed right to me, and she said, "Now supposing everyone had done that." Now, I didn't know what she was doing. She might not well have known what she was doing herself, but what she was doing was asking me, in effect, whether I had been following this Kantian categorical imperative. Act so that the maxim or the subjective rule of your action can be made a universal rule. And of course, I hadn't done that. And I was supposed to keep my mouth shut. But this is just an illustration of the law of practical reason. Now, this ethical perspective reveals the key to Immanuel Kant's philosophy. Here, commentators have found the deeper meaning, as we said, of Kant's relating of all experience and all thought to the I think. Richard Croner says this, that Kant was the first to set the I over against the world. That is, this I think, over against every possible object. There is a reflection then on the one who thinks, on the one who acts here in a more radical fashion than it was the case in the predecessors. Richard Croner says that Kant was the first to set the I over against the world understood then as the that which is the everything that can become a possible object, quote unquote, or in the German Gegenstand of thought. Kant sent the I over against everything that can become a possible object or Gegenstand of thought. Now here is the formal point of contact for moral autonomy. And Croner says that the Copernican deed, which made the I the center, which caused this reflection, this radical reflection on the I, is rooted in Kant's moral attitude. In this moral attitude, he's looking in an ethical direction for the unity of the self and for the freedom and dignity of man. Now, the ideal of science in this is supposed to be restricted to the finite world, the world of sense. Yes, indeed. If we look at the world of sense, if we look at the phenomenal world in which there's this pattern of finite experience we're just talking about, the subject related to a certain object or has a certain purpose, and you then discover the means for realizing that purpose. Yes, that's the phenomenal world. But the root of human autonomy and the root of human freedom is found, on the contrary, in a reflection on the ethical self. Now, Richard Croner wrote that the ethical worldview provided the key to Kant's philosophy. Kant's philosophy, he continues, is first of all an idealism of moral consciousness, an idealism of moral consciousness. And only then is it an idealism of consciousness in general. You look then at his analysis of thought. That's all very interesting. He talks about consciousness in general. But underlying that, as Croner says, and as we've also suggested, and Dooyeweerd also follows him in this, there is the moral thrust, there is the ethical thrust of Kant's position. The Copernican deed, which made the I, or the ego, the center, is anchored in Kant's moral attitude That is, in an attitude which discovers the source of human personality in ethical willing. Ethical willing. Let's note that carefully, because we're going to be returning in the next several lectures to the idea of ethical willing. And it's predominantly Kant, is preeminently Kant, who places moral will at the center of ethics. The ethical will, he maintains, is not that which subjects itself to an external idea of the good. It's not that we find some idea of good superordinated to ourselves, to which we subject ourselves, because Kant says no such good or no such goal can be good absolutely. Nothing within the pattern of the finite can be absolute. And any finite goal, any good that we would look to, cannot then be absolute. It's the ethical will, then, is not that which subjects itself to an external idea of the good. No such goal can be good absolutely. But it is exclusively the good will which can be good absolutely. So if you're going to look toward human personality, you're going to have to look not at this or that or the other goal or a good that a person might aim at, but it's the good will. That is what underlies everything, and which then gives us unity and direction. Now, the ethical will is that which subjects itself to the universal categorical imperative. If I'd been ethical, in other words, when I was in third grade, I would have kept my peace, you see, and certainly observed the admonitions of my teacher. If I am good ethically, or if I am true ethical will, my ethical willing will be subjecting itself, will subject itself to the universal categorical imperative. And it's through subjecting itself to this law, the law of the categorical imperative, that the I first comes to itself. When do I become identical with myself in my act? It's by, according to Kant, subjecting myself to this universal categorical imperative. It becomes a self, an autos, O-A-U-T-O-S. It becomes a self, an autos, as it subjects itself to the law, the nomos. It is autonomous. But it becomes a self, an autos, as it subjects itself to the law, the nomos. And so Kant finds that the law is the true I in the I. If you just look at yourself, looking inward, for example, you can say myself. On the other hand, when do I truly become a self? When I subject myself to the categorical imperative, I am itself as I subject myself to this law, the nomos, and so I have to look to the law, and that the law then is the true I in the I, is the true ego in the ego, or at least subjecting myself to the law here means that I am truly an I, I'm truly an ego, that I've truly come to myself. And so Kant can say, freedom is not simply an attribute of will. That is, if I think of my will, or I think about man, that man has will, and we have seen that Kant lays a great emphasis on will and on willing. If I simply think of the will, then I cannot say the will is free simply because it has the attribute of being free. I look at the will and it has this attribute or this characteristic that it is free. That's the wrong way to go. Freedom, Kant says, does not inhere in the will simply as a matter of fact, as an attribute would inhere in a thing. Instead, the freedom is only gotten then by way of this inner activity, that there is, by subjecting myself to this law, by subjecting myself to the categorical imperative, I constitute myself a self. And so freedom is so closely associated with human autonomy that I then subject myself to the law, but a law that belongs then truly to me. It's not outside of myself, but is identical with myself in its deeper ranges, in its deepest ranges. It's identical with myself as the deep, as my self in depth, which is to say then that it is then a law of reason. That I am identical with myself as reason. I am identical with myself in obeying the law, this law of the categorical imperative. And in obeying this, I actually constitute myself a self. Now here we find something that we were talking about even the first lecture, namely, it's so important to the humanistic idea of freedom, this idea of reason. Reason is not determined from the outside. On the contrary, reason prescribes, in the independence of maturity, the law of its own activity. We also said that for Immanuel Kant to then described in such a good way, you know, that was the heart and soul of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is then man's emergence from his self-imposed minority. Here, man comes to stand on his own feet, subject to no law outside of himself, but subject only to that law which is set by his reason itself, that is, comes out of reason itself, and so man is completely autonomous in his personality. So Kant could issue the appeal in view of this opposition we've had between the pattern in the phenomenal and the noumenal here in the ethical self. He could issue the appeal, and I quote, "Be an I, be a self, be a person and not a thing, be the subject of thy willing, all this is so much as to say, be free." Let me repeat that. And I quote, "Be an I, be a self, be a person and not a thing, be the subject of thy willing, all this is so much as to say, be free." And I have end quote here. Now, if we look then at this idea of freedom, looking at it simply from in a negative way, what we find here is that freedom for Kant is independence from all material conditionings. And when we use the word material here, we have to understand it in a special meaning. Material does not refer then to matter in the sense of stuff in the physical world, the physical universe. But if we remember what we've said about inner and outer, then material here will refer to everything which is outside of the self. Everything which is outside of the self that conditions the self from outside. And in a negative sense, then, freedom is the independence from all material conditionings. That is to say, conditioning by anything that resides outside of the self itself. Am I going to be free? I'm going to be autonomous, be identical with myself in my act. If I'm going to be determined from outside, that's a material determining then I am not free. And so, ethical compulsion, this ethical willing of which Kant spoke, must be an inner compulsion. There must be an inner willing, one arising then from the self. You can't even think here of will simply in a psychological or a psychical fashion, as some just simple impulse. But when we're talking about this ethical willing, or whatever it may be, it has to be something which is identical with the self. There has to be, if there's any compulsion, it must be an inner compulsion. The willing must be an inner willing, one arising from the self. Every other compulsion, that is, any compulsion that is not identical with the self, is external. And freedom, then, is freedom from, it is independence of all such material conditionings. Well, if this be so, Kant's doctrine of ethical willing, movement in the direction here, required the destruction of what is called metaphysics, in German, Seins Metaphysik, or metaphysics of being, the idea that there is some external set order which then simply holds for us. Moral consciousness, moral awareness, cannot be acknowledged in its unconditionedness and independence unless the world of being gives up its independence and unconditionedness. If you're going to have an... I shall say this, that if you are going to have the self as unconditioned, if you're going to have it escape the pattern of the finite, and if you're going to have a self which then has infinite worth and is truly autonomous, then what you have to do is to eliminate any independence that's outside of us, any unconditionedness in the world itself. So I said this, that moral consciousness cannot be acknowledged in its unconditionedness and independence unless the world of being gives up its independence and unconditionedness. And so you cannot have an idea of an ultimate order outside of man, which is an unconditioned order, and to which then man must give his unconditional response or obedience. All this has to fall away in the interest of man's ethical personality. And so it has been pointed out that one Kant's position requires the destruction of metaphysical system, or as I say again in the German, Seins Metaphysik. So it's only by way of obedience to law, which arises then from the depth of the self, that it will be decided whether one is to be elevated above the endless series of means and ends, or whether he is to be a mere link in the chain of empirical causes and effects. It's only then, by obedience to this categorical imperative, that you're going to be able to rise above the pattern of finiteness, which I described just a short time ago. And so, the autonomous positing of the law, subjecting yourself to the law at the same time knowing that this law is something which arises from your own nature as reason, this is the positive root, or the root of positive freedom. You think of freedom then in a negative sense as freedom from the external conditioning, then what is supposed to be at the heart of freedom in a positive sense is this autonomous positing of the law. So, freedom is not given. As we said, it cannot be regarded simply as an attribute of will, let us say, that we simply have free wills. But it is set as a goal. As Kant said, using the German terms, it is not gegeben, or G-E-G-E-B-E-N, gegeben, or simply given, but aufgegeben, A-U-F-G-E-G-E-B-E-N. It's then not simply given, but it is set for us, you might say, as a project, something we have to reach for, something that we have to have then in prospect. One ought to be free. And this belongs to the order required or demanded by reason. Reason demands that one be free. This belongs to the order demanded by reason. Further, Kant said, if one ought to be free, then he can be free. As we study in the institution at least a good number of years ago, we then learned that this was a rather typical Pelagian way of thinking. If one can do, if one ought to do something, then he can do it. Whereas, as over against that, in the Reformation time, of course, and in our Reformed and biblical way of looking at things, we know that we ought to be perfect before God. We ought to serve God with our whole heart, souls, and minds, and yet we know that we are unable to do so. It is only because Christ has died and only because we have the empowerment of the Holy Spirit that we are able to be saved, that we are able to do any good, and that not of ourselves. These things are gifts then of God. But in this way of thinking, in Kant's way of thinking, and a pattern which is typical of a Pelagian view, if you ought, then you can. And Kant said then, if we ought to be free, we can be free, we ought then to move ahead to be free, and so on. This is the way to human dignity and worth as Kant sees them. Acting in accordance with the categorical imperative, one constitutes himself a moral self. Constituting himself a moral being, one constitutes himself a self. Here we find then the seat of human freedom and dignity. Well, the self then determines itself apart from any external considerations. It determines itself apart from anything belonging to what falls outside of the self, to anything belonging to the phenomenal world, the world of sense. And so if one acts here, it does not act with reference to a particular object for a certain purpose. One does not believe in Jesus Christ in order to be saved, let us say. But one acts out of reverence for the moral law itself. Now, in some liberal theology, here you have you had the idea of the ethical self set over against the kind of pattern I just considered. You know, desire, a finite desire for eternal bliss with Jesus Christ in heaven. That is a finite goal because it falls within the pattern of finite. If you want something, then you do something. But ethical religion was supposed to be elevated above this, and here we find that this illustration is apropos here. As one acts, as an ethical being, he does not act with reference to any particular object for a particular purpose, but he acts out of reverence for the moral law itself. In so doing, he constitutes himself a self. As I act out of simple reverence for the moral law, I constitute myself a self, and I am self-determining. Now it is I who am determining myself. Now we've seen how Kant distinguished between the level of nature and that of freedom. Level of nature, where this finite pattern pertains, and the area of freedom. A freedom where one is involved in constituting himself a self. Between the level of heteronomy, where the law stands outside, where we have an object or a certain goal outside of ourselves, and that of the autonomous moral subject, where the law is identical with the depths, the deepest ranges of human self, which is reason. Now we have observed, too, that the elevation of the transcendental unity of apperception into the formal logical unity of all concepts and the lawgiver of nature is itself an expression of Kant's desire to preserve the autonomy and worth of the self. Kant wanted to preserve the autonomy and worth of the self, and that was the motor behind this, what I call this transcendental turn in his thinking. However, the idea of moral freedom as absolutely autonomous was never reconciled by Kant with the transcendental unity of apperception. Kant attempted to give human freedom a primacy over against nature, but he always remained enmeshed in a fundamental dualism between freedom and nature and between practical reason and theoretical reason. He tries to set these apart from each other, but continues to be enmeshed in a fundamental dualism between freedom and nature and between practical reason and theoretical reason. Natural necessity remains at the antipodes of the absoluteness of the moral idea of freedom. We shall be examining this a little bit further as we go along. There are going to be those who say, yes, Kant, you turned in the right direction, but you did not go far enough. We shall see that attitude in the thought of Fichte. Well, Kant then, too, in turning toward the moral and separating it out dualistically from everything that has to do with sense experience, Kant's doing this avenged itself, as Hermann Dooyeweerd points out, in a logical formalism in the treatment of ethical questions. It is said, yes, when Kant says you should follow the categorical imperative, that is then the norm of your action, act so that the subjective rule of your action can become a universal rule. You indeed have a form of ethical action, but it doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you at all what to do. There is an introduction of a logical formalism in the treatment of ethical questions. And Kant has no place for the individual in his ethics. Let me finish the story then about my encounter with my teacher in third grade, if you will allow me. Again, I'm sure that you may have heard the latter part of the story as well as the first part, but it is relevant. My retort to the teacher when she says, Bob, supposing everyone had done that, my retort, and again, I didn't know of what I was doing, I said, but not everyone did. In other words, if everyone had all of a sudden made the wise crack, it wouldn't have had any sense whatsoever, but not everyone did, and possibly the wise crack was funny. Well, I'm not saying whether it was funny or not, or proper or improper. I'm just using this episode as it happened from third grade to illustrate something here. In other words, there's a way of looking at things if you are to subject your actions this way that everything you do can become a universal rule. It is said that this has no place for the individual for the unique. It has no place for, well, as persons have said, for humor, philosophy of humor, in which you do not have simply the universal, but in which the individual is very important. Kant, furthermore, is understood to have the problem of the thing in itself. You are attempting to grasp in your understanding the entire manifold, the manifoldness of your experience. You're trying to come to unity. But this, as you reach out and try to understand the thing, it escapes you. You're never able to get there. But Kant still maintained that there was a thing itself out there, or the thing in itself out there, toward which you were moving, toward which you then were struggling and moving ahead. And if you're going to have one part of us thinking that the faculty of sense in our experience of the phenomenal world is going to be receptive, then it's receptive because there's a thing in itself out there and our experience comes toward us and we receive this experience. But is there not then something? Is there not this thing out there which is unable to be reconciled with the free moral self as autonomous? If it's out there, don't I have then to recognize? Maybe I don't know it, but it's still, see, there's this element of passivity in my experiencing here. And is that able to be rhymed with the self-creation that I'm actually involved in counting constituting myself a self? Is this able to be reconciled? Is it able to be squared with the free moral self as autonomous? Now, it is said that since Kant allowed the thing in itself to be outside the self, it was not possible, or it was impossible for him to regard human freedom as the most fundamental root of the cosmos. Because the thing in itself was still out there. Even though we couldn't, or always aiming toward it, never could reach it. It was impossible then for him to think of human freedom as the most fundamental root of the cosmos. And under the influence of the freedom motive, under the influence of this we're talking about, that here is the ideal of freedom and here is the ideal of personality, then, you know, consciously encroaching upon in opposition to the science ideal. Under this influence, the thing in itself came to be regarded as an insult to sovereign reason. It's an insult to me. It's an insult to my reason. It's an insult to my freedom that thing is out there. And he nows, get rid of it. It was in ficta that such a shift came. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, capital Fichte. That a shift came, in which there was an attempt to make human freedom into the origin of the entire cosmos. And if you're going to understand the cosmos as a whole, you have to understand it in terms of the freedom of sovereign personality. And this includes nature. And so for Fichte, human freedom became the root, it became the origin of the entire cosmos, including the realm of nature. Does nature have any meaning? It will have meaning then as the terrain for the deployment of human freedom. Freedom became the root, including the realm of nature. And so, Dooyeweerd maintains that in Fichte, one discovers a pure expression of the personality ideal in opposition to the science ideal. In fact, there is an attempt here to take up the latter that is, to take up the science ideal into the personality ideal, there is a radical expression of human freedom and autonomy in Fichte. Now, we deal at the very end here with this transition to idealism. Now, immediately after Kant, then, there was a development within German idealism of a pure idealism. We might say there was the rise of idealism, a pure idealism. Various interrelated objections were lodged against Kant's position. The criticism went this way, as I mentioned. He had failed to carry through with major lines of thought that he himself had initiated. He started out in the right direction, he started out in the wrong path, and he didn't go far enough. In the few minutes that remain, let us very quickly summarize some of the major objections that were lodged against Kant's philosophy, and we'll review these things next time. In the first place, as I've suggested, there were objections to Kant's formalism. Objections were lodged against the Kantian view of the categorical imperative. It was completely formal, without any material content. The point was that a subjective maxim be made a universal rule. But such a rule was applicable without reference to its content, and not every content with unconditional value could be expressed as a universal rule. In the second place, there was the problem of synthesis. Kant was also criticized for not having approached properly the problem of synthesis. We'll return to this later. Kant regarded the transcendental self too much on the order of a higher general law to which the empirical laws would be subsumed. Then, however, one would still be faced with the problem of the synthesis between the general and the particular. Kant, it was said, had not solved the problem of synthesis, which requires a fusion of the universal and the particular. We noticed that Kant aimed for the universal, and he didn't really solve the problem of the particular. He didn't fuse them together. He didn't solve the question of synthesis. This required a fusion of the universal and particular, of spirit and nature. But Kant left spirit and nature, the noumenal and the phenomenal, over against each other in an unreconciled, and we might say unreconcilable, tension. Now, the entire history of idealistic thought after Kant has been interpreted as a wrestling with the problem as to whether the self has been truly delivered from being subject to that which lies outside of it. And furthermore, we might say that this problem of synthesis, as we shall find out next time, was a very important thing. How do you bring together the universal and the particular, and so on? Then in the third place, we have again this matter of the thing in itself. The claim that Kant had allowed for something outside the self centered in a criticism of his idea of the thing in itself. That Kant retained the idea of the thing in itself was attacked as not being in agreement with the basic thrust of his philosophy. The idea of the thing in itself was attacked as a hindrance to solving the problem of synthesis. How, if this is out there, this being in itself is simply out there somewhere, how are you going to bring it together with yourself as an autonomous being? How are you going to draw things together instead of simply leaving them apart? That would also be a major question. In Kant's philosophy, so the critic said, the thing in itself constitutes a counterpoise to the self, something to which the self is yet subject, something which is alien to it. And this thing in itself immediately becomes a problem, and the theme already begins to enter in of alienation and how there can be reconciliation between the self understood in its personality, in its creative personality, and that then which is alien because it has not been, it seems to be unable to be reconciled with the self.